Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 4, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, our expert will give a litigation and legislative update on Second Amendment rights. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Alan Gura, partner at Gurin PLLC. I will turn it over to Mr. Gura to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much and good afternoon, everybody. The tragic shooting in Las Vegas this past weekend has once again brought to the forefront our nation's permanent debate on the topic of gun control. It is only natural that gun policy be a topic of political discussion on which people often hold forceful opposing views. I sincerely hope that we can amicably navigate this debate as a society towards an effective solution that would prevent or reduce the occurrence of such atrocities. But if you are tuning into this discussion hoping for a political or criminological presentation, you may be disappointed. The focus of this call today is the status and foreseeable future of Second Amendment litigation. Federal, state, and local laws pervasively regulate who may have guns, what types of guns people may have, and what people may do with those guns and under what conditions. All of these laws at least implicate the fundamental individual right to keep and bear arms, a legal field that is still in its formative stages. Courts are wrestling with a variety of different Second Amendment challenges. And quite apart from one's views on the benefits or harms of individual gun ownership, how courts are approaching the subject merits review. While my practice is by no means limited to this topic, I am involved in a fair number of Second Amendment lawsuits throughout the country. I'd like to share with you my perspective, not as a social scientist, which I am not, but as a constitutional litigator. We start from two points of apparent consensus. First, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's instructions in D.C. versus Heller and McDonald versus Chicago that the Second Amendment secures a fundamental right to keep and bear arms for self-defense, the lower courts, the lower federal courts in particular, are largely hostile to any claim for relief based on the Second Amendment. As long ago now as 2012, former Brady Center attorney and now a professor and associate dean of the University of Missouri Kansas City's Law School, Alan Rostrum, published an article describing how Justice Breyer's dissent in the Heller case had effectively become that case's controlling opinion. And just last year, UCLA professor Richard Ray published an insightful law review article on the phenomenon by which lower courts are narrowing from below those Supreme Court opinions which are simply too impractical or erroneous to implement. Given this widespread practice, the professor wrote, Heller was becoming largely symbolic. This brings me to the second point of consensus. This state of affairs exists because, for whatever reason, the Supreme Court accepts it. Since the McDonald case in 2010, the court has not accepted a single Second Amendment case for argument. And apart from one brief per curiam decision that Justice Alito rightfully termed as grudging, the Supreme Court has said nothing about the right to arms in over 7 years. Not for lack of opportunity. The court has been presented with numerous high-quality petitions raising circuit splits and important federal questions in cases arising under a wide array of circumstances. In the interest of full disclosure, some of these unsuccessful cert petitions were mine. But just as I'm not limited to litigating the Second Amendment litigation is by no means limited to me. The court has denied high-quality cert petitions by a variety of prominent practitioners, including multiple petitions by Paul Clement in Peruta versus California and NRA versus ATF, Dave Thompson of Cooper and Kirk, Friedman versus Highland Park and Shrew v. Malloy, one petition in the early post-Heller days, DeLacy versus California, brought by Chuck Michelle and John Eastman, and other highly skilled attorneys. This past June, we welcomed former acting Solicitor General Jeff Wall to the club of unsuccessful Second Amendment petitioners. In January, shortly before leaving town, the Obama administration petitioned the Supreme Court to review the case of Bindurup versus Attorney General, a consolidated case that I had won first in the Eastern and Middle Districts of Pennsylvania and then before the en banc Third Circuit on an 8-7 vote. In Bindurup, the Court of Appeals affirmed, two judgments that had struck down applications of the federal so-called felon in possession ban for violating the Second Amendment. Please keep in mind that the Solicitor General's office typically succeeds in getting its cert petitions granted. In Binderup, we had a landmark case where a sharply divided en banc court had enjoined the central federal gun law, and there is undeniably a circuit split on this critical topic. Nonetheless, after six relists, only Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor voted to grant the government's petition, two justices short of the four needed to grant the petition. The circuit split implicated in Binderup is one that, unusually in this area, tilts in favor of individuals and against the government. Only two circuits, the Fourth and the Tenth, have sided with the government's view, rejecting the notion that individuals who are barred from having guns on account of a criminal conviction can nonetheless come to court and argue that under their particular facts and circumstances, disarmament is unconstitutional. The Third, Seventh, Eighth, and D.C. circuits have all acknowledged that while the government can disarm categories of people who have committed various crimes, there will be individual cases where there is no traditionally accepted reason for depriving someone of Second Amendment rights, even though they are caught up in these categories. The First and Ninth Circuits have signaled their openness to considering the issue. The problem is widespread. While some states disarm people for having committed a crime that appears on a list of disabling offenses, other states and the federal government utilize a broad categorical approach that bans people from having guns if they were convicted of any crime that carries a particular sentencing range or classification. Challenges to these dispossession laws have been brought by people who have permanently lost Second Amendment rights for having been convicted of nonviolent felonies, including having made a false statement on a mortgage application, infringing copyrights, and backdating stock options. Challenges have also been brought by people convicted of misdemeanor offenses that triggered a firearm disability owing to the potential sentencing range under state law, including unlicensed gun possession in a moving vehicle, corruption of minors, and simple DUI. For people interested in reading further on this subject, I'd recommend starting with Kevin Marshall's article in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, Why Can't Martha Stewart Have a Gun? Courts that approve of these challenges point out that the Supreme Court in Heller stated that felon dispossession laws are only presumptively lawful, and presumptions can be overcome in as-applied challenges. If the law were otherwise, then the scope of the Second Amendment right could be defined legislatively. A legislature could declare anything to be a felony or prescribe a lengthy potential prison sentence for any misdemeanor and thereby disarm people who commit any sort of infraction. But even judges who agree that there exists the potential for as-applied relief disagree as to the standards. In Binderup, for example, three of the eight judges in the majority offered that the Second Amendment disarms people who are not virtuous, and they offered a somewhat complicated test for virtuousness. The other five judges focused, as I argued, on dangerousness as being the relevant inquiry when seeking to disarm people. The Supreme Court will soon have another chance to explore this dispute. Distributed for a later October conference, sometime this very day, perhaps right now, is my petition on behalf of James Hamilton, who was disarmed by Maryland for a nonviolent credit card felony in Virginia. Virginia's governor and courts fully restored Mr. Hamilton's rights, and under the operation of federal law, that also caused his federal gun rights to be automatically restored. Hamilton became a licensed security guard and firearms instructor before moving on to his current job as a Department of Homeland Security federal protective officer. Unfortunately, however, Mr. Hamilton lives in Maryland, whose government still bars him from having a gun at home on account of his conviction. The Fourth Circuit, easily among the top three most hostile courts for any gun-related case, had recognized as-applied relief in Second Amendment cases on several prior occasions where the felon was plainly not meritorious. But when it came time to apply this precedent to a rehabilitated person, the court narrowed its precedent by holding that as-applied relief would be available only to felons who had been pardoned or whose conviction was unlawful. Maryland initially waived its response to the petition, but the court requested a response nonetheless. If the Supreme Court doesn't want to resolve the issue now, I'm sure that it will be presented with additional petitions by individuals and governments alike on a regular basis. The Fourth Circuit will provide the Supreme Court with two additional chances to address the Second Amendment this term. First, in the NRA-backed case of Colby versus Hogan, the court might review the Fourth Circuit's en banc decision upholding Maryland's restrictions on so-called assault rifles and allegedly high-capacity magazines. The court has previously rejected petitions from unsuccessful NRA-backed challenges to similar laws. In the earlier cases, courts accepted that such arms were in common use for traditional lawful purposes, or at least did not wish to dispute the plain evidence of that fact. Without question, Americans own many millions of these rifles and magazines, and while they do feature in some horrific atrocities, on the whole, such arms are not typically used in crime. Nonetheless, using a deferential form of intermediate scrutiny, courts have sustained such bans on that the government has a sufficient interest in banning them. The government's burden in such cases can be low. For example, the Seventh Circuit affirmed an assault weapons ban because, and I'm quoting here, if it has no other effect, the ordinance may increase the public's sense of safety. Mass shootings are rare, but they are highly salient, and people tend to overestimate the likelihood of salient events. If a ban on semi-automatic guns and large capacity magazines reduces the perceived risk from a mass shooting and makes the public feel safer as a result, that's a substantial benefit. Close quote. Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. The Fourth Circuit's innovation in Colby was to actually hold that common semi-automatic rifles are weapons of war outside the Second Amendment's protection. But its alternative holding mirrored those of earlier courts that had upheld the assault weapons laws on an interest balancing theory. We'll see if the court has developed a taste for this sort of case. I'm skeptical, but hopeful. The other Fourth Circuit case touching on Second Amendment rights up for the court's review this term is the en banc decision in U.S. versus Robinson, where the appeals court held that anyone carrying a gun is inherently dangerous and thus subject to a stop and frisk. Since gun carrying is legal and fairly common in much of the United States, Robinson essentially holds, as the dissent warned, that people must choose between Second and Fourth Amendment rights. Judge Wynn, concurring in the judgment, made that explicit, adding that, and I'm quoting, individuals who elect to carry firearms forgo other constitutional rights, like the Fourth Amendment right to have law enforcement officers knock and announce before forcibly entering homes. Likewise, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that individuals who choose to carry firearms necessarily face greater restriction on their concurrent exercise of other constitutional rights, like those protected by the First Amendment, close quote. Hopefully the court will take a look at Robinson. But along the same lines, there is another important petition before the court this term from the similarly gun-hostile 11th Circuit, Young v. Borders. In this tragic case, Lake County, Florida sheriff's deputies conducted a warrantless raid on a dwelling at 1:30 in the morning without announcing themselves as police, merely because they were looking for a motorcyclist and there was a motorcycle parked near the home. When the law-abiding, non-suspect resident responded to the loud banging on his door, holding a gun at his side pointed safely at the floor, the police shot him dead within 2 seconds of his opening the door. The 11th Circuit affirmed the granting of qualified immunity on the theory that one must choose between Second and Fourth Amendment rights. Full disclosure, I filed an amicus brief in Young v. Borders on behalf of the Second Amendment Foundation, urging the court to take another look at this case. Another notable Second Amendment petition coming before the court this term is Sylvester versus Becerra. In Sylvester, California gun owners won a judgment at trial in the federal district court to the effect that the state was violating their Second Amendment rights by forcing them to undergo waiting periods for gun purchases, notwithstanding the fact that they already had guns, calling into question the value of any waiting period as a so-called cooling off mechanism. But the Ninth Circuit reversed. As with Hamilton, the court has called for a response to the petition, which is being handled by Eric Jaffe. Finally, for the current term, I think, is Norman versus Florida. Florida allows people to carry handguns concealed for self-defense, making a license for that activity fairly available. But the state does not allow the open carry of a handgun. Mr. Norman believes the prohibition on open carry specifically violates his Second Amendment rights. Personally, this is not a view that I share or litigate in my cases, but it's worth noting that here, too, the court has requested a response. There is obviously an eagerness by someone on the Supreme Court to read more briefs on the Second Amendment subject. Of course, there's another handgun carry case waiting in the wings. That would be Wren versus DC, a case that I've been handling now for the past 2 years. in Wren, the D.C. Circuit struck down Washington, D.C.'s requirement that anyone who wishes to carry a handgun for self-defense demonstrate a good reason for doing so. It's odd to think of a fundamental right that people can exercise only if the police think it's a good reason. It's even odder if, by definition, the police's discretionary standard is supposed to deny the right to nearly the entire community, save for rare exceptions. Four circuits had upheld such laws on the theory that even if there is a right to carry a handgun for self-defense, a proposition usually accepted in federal court, the state has a strong interest in rationing that right as a means of reducing the harms allegedly associated with it. To some, the Wren decision is thus a startling outlier. I would disagree. The unfortunately unsuccessful litigation in other circuits was much closer than it appears on the surface. In the Third Circuit, New Jersey's law was upheld over a strong dissent, and the en banc vote was 8-4. The Supreme Court relisted that petition twice. In the Fourth Circuit, Maryland's law was struck down by the district court, only to be reversed on appeal. The Ninth Circuit initially struck down California's law, only to reverse itself en banc. And the Seventh Circuit struck down Illinois' total gun carry ban in an opinion that is wholly incompatible with a D.C.-style restrictive carry scheme. In the D.C. Circuit itself, Wren is not much of an outlier. In Heller 3, the D.C. Circuit struck down Washington's law restricting the number of guns that a person may purchase by specifically rejecting the city's rights rationing argument. En banc rehearing was denied in that case as well. And so I, at least, was not entirely shocked that essentially the same D.C. Circuit didn't wish to review Wren either. I suppose a petition for certiorari in Wren might well be granted, given the importance of the issue and the circuit split. I'd be delighted to argue the case in the Supreme Court. But considering the Supreme Court's denial of cert in Binderup, it's hard to be certain that that court would grant a petition by the city to review Wren. And I wouldn't be entirely shocked if the other side would back off from filing a petition, just as Illinois did not wish to try its luck in Morvey Madigan, where that state's carry ban was struck down by the Seventh Circuit, and Chicago did not wish to test the Supreme Court in Ezell 1 and Ezell 2 concerning that city's ill-fated efforts to ban gun ranges. Even if the city were to file for cert in Wren, looking at the calendar, it's very unlikely that the case could be briefed, argued, and decided in the current term. Any Supreme Court decision in Wren would likely be a June 2019 event. Looking to the next term, the courts of appeals have a variety of other interesting Second Amendment cases that would provide strong cert petitions regardless of their outcomes. Several years ago, I won a case in the Northern District of Texas called Mance v. Holder. It's Mance v. Sessions now, on the federal government's appeal. In Mance, the court struck down the federal ban on interstate handgun sales. Americans who wish to buy rifles and shotguns across state lines can do so, provided that they undergo a background check run by a licensed dealer and the dealer complies with the laws of the dealer state and the purchaser's home state. Not so for handguns, where a person can only take possession of a handgun from a licensed dealer in his or her home state. There's no reason why gun dealers can follow other states' rifle and shotgun laws, but not the handgun laws. And some jurisdictions would prefer that their residents buy their guns elsewhere. Washington, D.C., which has no gun stores and only one federally licensed dealer who can effectuate transfers, has changed its rules to ensure that such interstate handgun sales would be permissible should federal law change. I argued that case in the Fifth Circuit in January of last year. I'm sure that whatever happens at the panel stage, no decision yet, it will be the subject of an en banc petition. Finally, two cases heard by the Ninth Circuit this past March, one of which the Ninth Circuit heard en banc, bear watching. Pena versus Lindley is a challenge I argued to California's handgun roster law, which is banning an increasingly large number of ordinary handguns for not containing design features preferred by legislators but not by the market. Indeed, one such mandatory feature, micro stamping, is not available anywhere, a circumstance that is forcing a slow motion prohibition of all new semi-automatic handgun sales. The en banc case of Teixeira versus County of Alameda concerns the question of whether the Second Amendment bars a local government from restrictively zoning gun stores. A panel held that a gun store could raise such a Second Amendment challenge, but we will see what the Ninth Circuit thinks of that en banc, and then perhaps the Supreme Court. There are doubtless other such cases that I could discuss, but at this time, let's open the call and hear from some of you.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for that first question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, October 5th at 1 p.m. That will be a special Courthouse Steps call on two different cases recently argued in the Supreme Court, District of Columbia v. Wesby and Class v. United States. That call feature William J. Hahn, associate at Sherman and Sterling. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, good afternoon, Ms. Segura. Great job in the Wren case. I don't think you addressed in your remarks about the concealed carry reciprocity issue, or if you did, you kind of flew by it fast because you were covering a lot of territory. And I was wondering about your thoughts on the concealed carry reciprocity and also the question of rather than waiting for Congress to do anything, which we know Congress never does much of anything, whether there's any thoughts of litigation to challenge some jurisdiction's refusal to accept, for example, my Virginia concealed carry permit.
Well, thank you for the question. I'm not aware of any litigation right now concerning reciprocity as such. Typically, courts will acknowledge that states may enact their own laws to regulate firearms, and the laws of one state may be different than those of another. What's important, of course, is that the Second Amendment sets a floor beneath which no state may fall. States right now have a patchwork, a quilt of reciprocity agreements that are ever shifting. But generally speaking, the very few restrictive states don't recognize very many permits, especially not from those states that issue the permits to carry on a very generous shall issue basis. Congress has indicated some interest in perhaps legislating this. I am personally skeptical that Congress has a Commerce Clause authority to do so, although my views of the Commerce Clause are by no means those that prevail in the court, so they might get away with it. I do, however, believe that Congress has the authority under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to make sure that states and localities don't violate the civil rights of their citizens and the citizens of the United States. The Second Amendment secures a fundamental right which applies as against local and state entities, and so I think Congress could act, if not so much to force a recognition of out-of-state permits, to at least force states and localities to have constitutionally adequate licensing mechanisms that give people access to this important right.
So would you consider any litigation to try to push this?
I don't discuss which litigation I'm thinking or not thinking about. I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you that.
Sure.
You know anything that I can tell you that I'm not aware of any current lawsuits that are pressing the issue. I will say this though. I might add, and then we can move on to another question. If the Supreme Court were to hold that states must provide some access to this right, even if through a licensing mechanism on a shall issue basis, then I predict that as simply the practical measure, you will see the states solving this problem on their own. If every state has to allow people to carry a gun to defend themselves, then I'm sure that we could work out something that reduces the transactional costs on the states themselves to make sure that this happens seamlessly.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Mr. Gura. This is Cody Wisniewski from Mountain States Legal Foundation. I joined the call a couple minutes late, so I don't know if you've addressed this, but in the Peruta dissent, the Justice Thomas joined by Gorsuch, do you think that their view that the Supreme Court needs to be taking more of these Second Amendment cases, do you think that that's going to actually have any sort of effect on the court? Is the court going to start granting certain these cases and deciding these issues, or is it going to continue to deny certain and leave them to this patchwork of circuit issues?
You know, I do believe this. It seems unlikely that we were going to go another 10, 20, 30, 50 years without any more decisions from the Supreme Court about this subject. At some point in time, one would imagine that the court addresses the issue, and it's not surprising to see one or several justices needle their colleagues and sort of try to nudge them along to take a case. The only thing that we can reasonably deduce from the court's behavior over the past 7 years is that there is no consensus right now about the Second Amendment, or at least that the justices are not themselves comfortable with the topic. They're not sure how they might decide it. And so they'd rather just leave it alone. At some point, that will change, whether that comes from some epiphany that a holdout justice might experience, or whether that comes from a change in composition in that room as justices leave the bench and others take their place. One doesn't know. But all I can tell you is commonly observed, is that the Supreme Court has had many opportunities to opine on this subject. And as we've seen from Justice Thomas's latest work in the Peruta dissent from the denial of the cert petition, there's an acknowledgement that if they wanted to take it, they would have plenty of good opportunities to do so. But we'll see. We'll find out sooner or later.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Is there anything else you'd like to expand on that you didn't get to cover in your opening remarks?
No, I think I've just about covered the current cases before the court as I see them and the sort of the cases that are coming up. This is going to get decided at some future point. And I will say this, there's an awful lot of speculation swirling around the internet and other places as to why the court hasn't taken a case, when they might do so. We really, of course, have no way of knowing, and it's probably not a very effective use of our time to play these parlor games and wonder about which justice is the issue and in which way they might be leaning. What we do know, however, is that it's been a strange long time without any kind of statement from the court, and that silence will be broken someday. Whether that happens this term or next or 5 years from now, I don't know. But someday we're going to learn more about the Second Amendment from the Supreme Court. Until that day occurs, unfortunately, the lower courts are also aware of this phenomenon, and they're doing what they want. Heller's become optional precedent. There are judges who follow it, who care about it, and decide cases one way or another with some reference point, and then unfortunately we are seeing some decisions that look to be much more creative in how they reach their result. That's also a phenomenon that's widely acknowledged.
Looks like we have two questions pending now, so I'll go ahead and go to the first caller.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were going to be, given what happened in Las Vegas, and it seems like he had several different attachments onto his weapon, specifically like the bump stock. What would the likelihood be of seeing maybe legislation regarding attachments rather than outright bans on, say, the amorphous assault rifle ban?
Well, I'm not sure what Congress would do legislatively. I have seen some news reports that there are people considering now taking a look at the so-called bump fire mechanisms, which is basically a device that increases the rate of speed at which a semi-automatic weapon can fire. My sense of it is, as a constitutional matter, that it's easier to go after bump firing stocks and things of that nature than it is to go after the underlying weapon, because a gun that fires semi-automatically is very plain vanilla technology today. Most weapons function that way. And you can't simply ban all semi-automatic firearms. The people who make such statements don't really know what they're talking about. That would effectively ban virtually all firearms. I don't think that could be sustained. However, if you look at a device that that turns a normal semi-automatic firearm into what is essentially a fully automatic machine gun, I believe the courts would uphold laws that restrict such devices. Whether you think that those laws are a good idea or not, the courts would say that fully automatic weapons are probably not arms that would be in common use for any traditional lawful purposes. There's no machine gun season on deer. You wouldn't use a machine gun to defend yourself against a mugger in a parking lot somewhere necessarily. And so while people can always envision using these tools in some lawful, constructive way, courts are going to be far more skeptical. There have been challenges to the various machine gun restrictions that we have in this country. They've all failed. They've failed quite spectacularly. I don't foresee any success by people who challenge those restrictions. And so if Congress wanted to go after that particular item, I don't foresee that there would be a difficulty. I mean, it might get litigated, but I don't think that that law would be vulnerable to attack.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Mr. Guerra. This is Chris Hollinger calling from the Hampton Roads Lawyers Chapter. Thanks a lot for the insightful comments you've made. I thought I remembered a case out of California, perhaps last year or the year before, that was focused on California restrictions on ammunition purchases and the effect that they were having, and the possibility that either a municipality or the state of California was effectively trying to make it impossible to use your gun because you couldn't get ammunition. Is that case still in play? Is that still going on, or is that something that's still out there that you could comment on?
I haven't followed that very closely. I am aware that there's some ammunition litigation in California. What's interesting in California, of course, is that there's a decision from the Ninth Circuit in a case called Jackson versus City and County of San Francisco. And one of the things that Jackson dealt with was a restriction on certain types of ammunition in San Francisco. And the Ninth Circuit held, although it sustained the laws, the Ninth Circuit seemed to extend Second Amendment protection to ammunition specifically. And of course, I don't think it could have gone any other way. Guns are covered by the Second Amendment, and it would seem that anything that's essential to making the gun function, such as ammunition, would also be protected as well. I don't think that the government, for example, could simply ban all the ammunition and say, ha ha, you know, we haven't touched your guns. You can keep your guns, but you'll never be able to possess or make ammunition for it. That would fly. So ammunition, I believe, is protected by the Second Amendment, and laws that restrict it are going to get challenged, and some of those laws will fail. The current status of ammunition litigation, I'm afraid I'm not up on right now, but it's an area to watch.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any new callers, would you like to make some closing remarks?
I just want to thank everybody for being on the call. I know that this is a difficult topic for many people on both sides. It's important, however, that we remember that the Second Amendment, whatever it means, does not tell courts simply to uphold the good laws and strike down the bad laws. It actually secures an individual right, and it's the job of lawyers and courts to figure out what the contours of that right might be, and then to apply them in specific cases. And that's a very different task than simply arguing about, you know, which kind of gun laws you'd like to see enacted or struck down.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.